After a couple of semesters at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Bob Bergdahl knew that college wasn't for him. His parents had taught him to read widely and stay informed, and though he had plans to major in anthropology, he was also a nationally ranked cyclist with his eyes on the Olympics, and didn't see much sense in spending more time in classrooms listening to professors explain what he could learn on his own. The Bergdahls of 1960s Santa Monica were a family of brainy athletes, all-American California Republicans. Bob's mother volunteered for presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, and in their liberal, Jewish Santa Monica neighborhood, Bob's father was the only guy on the block wearing a Nixon button. Robert Bergdahl Sr. had been an all-star blocking back for the UCLA Bruins, played in 2 Rose Bowls, and returned to coach 8 seasons after he graduated. Bob's sister was a nationally ranked swimmer and an alternate for the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich when she was just 16 years old. Bob was on a similar path. By his senior year in high school, his family had moved to Santa Barbara, and he had become one of the fastest road and track cyclists in the country. After qualifying for the U.S. Junior World Team in 1978, he trained alongside future 3-time Tour de France champion Greg LeMond and Chris Carmichael, who would go on to a career as Lance Armstrong's personal coach. As much as he liked road racing, Bob was better on the track, where the velodrome and the track bike's fixed gears demanded intense focus. At 70 miles per hour, one uneven pedal stroke could send him careening into the walls. Just slowing down required a coordinated resistance against the inertia of the machine. After winning several Olympic development races in California, the U.S. Cycling Federation invited him to Colorado Springs, Colorado, to train with the development team ahead of the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow. He was more focused than at any time in his life, and it looked as if he might qualify, until Friday night, January 4th, 1980, when current events collided with his Olympic dream. Networks cut away from primetime programming for President Jimmy Carter's live national address from the Oval Office. On Christmas Day, 50,000 troops of the Soviet 40th Army had invaded the small, non-aligned sovereign nation of Afghanistan. Moscow, Carter said, was attempting to conquer the fiercely independent Muslim people of that country. Protests, many organized and encouraged by American and Western intelligence agencies, erupted in capitals across Europe and the Muslim world. In Bangladesh, a mob stormed the gated campus of the Soviet Cultural Center. Muslim demonstrators marched with dirty sandals tied to placards, threatening Soviet Prime Minister Leonid Brezhnev's life. In London, the crowds carried signs that read, "Russians are invaders. Let Afghans choose their own government. No East, no West, Islam is the best." Publicly, the White House shared in the outrage. From the Oval Office, Carter warned the Soviets about the dangers of empire building. "History teaches perhaps very few clear lessons, but surely one such lesson learned by the world at great cost is that aggression, unopposed, becomes a contagious disease." Claiming that Soviet militarism endangered the lives of athletes and spectators in Moscow, Carter threatened an Olympic boycott. The White House was already preoccupied with Afghanistan's neighbor to the west. At Christmas time, more than 50 Americans remained hostage inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, and Carter didn't have many good options in either country. 4 years after the fall of Saigon, another American war in Asia was unthinkable. Looking for any political leverage they could find, the White House and CIA saw potential in Islamic fundamentalism and framed the anti-Soviet sentiments spreading across the Muslim world as inherently pro-democracy. By summertime, Carter's Olympic boycott had swelled to 60 countries. But privately, in the corridors of the Pentagon, the CIA, and Capitol Hill, the Soviet invasion was a welcome development and had come as no surprise. 6 months earlier, on July 3, 1979, Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, had encouraged the president to begin arming a network of loosely affiliated Pashtun tribal militias already fighting the Soviets from their homeland along the Afghan-Pakistani border. In notes Brzezinski handed Carter that day, he predicted that the Muslim rebels could lure the Soviets into an Afghan trap. Brzezinski saw cycles of history at work. Afghanistan was a storied battleground, the graveyard of empires, where the great powers of 19th century Europe played their great game. If the Russians were foolish enough to drift into an Afghan quagmire, Washington was happy to pull them in deeper. Weeks after the Christmas invasion, Brzezinski flew to Pakistan to recruit and coordinate a wider international effort. Afghanistan's eastern neighbor had a vital self-interest in the American plan, and its spy agency, the Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, was the only government entity in the world with influence over the Pashtun tribes in its western provinces. The U.S. and Pakistani-led coalition recruited support from Egypt, the U.K., China, and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis agreed to match American investment dollar for dollar.